From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunath Cheesh, Hawa, Toksik Nusam, Salama. Thank you for joining the conversation. Today, Southeast Clams, Dangerous or Delicious? We chat with John Harley ahead of his Friday fireside lecture at the Mendenhall Glacier. Our first check-in of the year with the Juneau Police Department with Deputy Chief Craig Campbell. And the Juneau Nordic Ski Club is on a mission with their upcoming Communiski fundraiser. Raise a dollar for every Juneauite to assist in offering the opportunity for every kid to ski. Those conversations plus the Seabank Chronicles and more coming up this hour on Juneau Afternoon. A quick announcement. Tonight, February 19th at 7 p.m. at UAS Egan Lecture Hall, Current Developments on Immigration Law. This forum, presented by Alaskan attorneys and immigration leaders, provides information on current developments on immigration law and their potential impacts on Juneau's immigrant community. There will be speakers from Alaska Immigration Justice Project, American Civil Liberties Union Alaska, and Refugee Assistance and Immigration Services Program. That's tonight at 7 p.m. out at UAS, the Current Developments on Immigration Law.
Hanson Gress, Ka eat with the shoe ye, we kashuk a ye tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta kanakaya ha anikak, gunish cheesh.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. You are listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm Boston Christopher. This Friday, February 21st, researcher and UAS assistant professor John Harley will lead a fireside chat at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitors Center beginning at 7 p.m. Clams in Southeast, delicious or dangerous? Doors open at 6:30 p.m. You can find out more at the Mendenhall Glacier Facebook page or searching for fireside chats at Mendenhall Glacier in your favorite search engine. John joins me now in studio. Gunath Cheesh, Ayigudi. Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to have you here. Wasiet, how's it going?
It's going great. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So let's first talk about you, and then we'll get to this talk, because I'm fascinated by the history. And if anybody knows, it reminded me, having you on today reminded me in my researching that there is this wonderful website called scholar.google.com. And on that website, you can find information about all of these people and their research and what the things you've done. And you've done a lot of research on clams. And so I'm just curious about you and where you began and how do you get started into talking and looking into clams?
Yeah, that's a great question. I started out as my research career is doing my marine biology bachelor's degree at UC Santa Cruz. I worked a lot with marine mammals while I was there, and then I went to grad school, did my PhD up at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I continued to do research with marine mammals, but also branched out into some other species, and my overarching research questions are all related to environmental toxicology, so toxins in the environment, both human-produced and naturally occurring. And I got into working with clams when I started a postdoc here at the University of Alaska Southeast at the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center. Clams are great to work with. They don't move very much, and so they're pretty easy to find in most cases. We have a lot of them here in Juneau, so it's a great study species.
Have you always been sort of an outdoors or seafaring individual?
Yeah, very much so. I grew up in San Diego, and I was always fascinated with the tide pools there, and spent a lot of time in the ocean as a kid. And moving up here to Fairbanks was actually the furthest I've ever been from an ocean. And I had a great time up there, but I'm much more at home here in Juneau.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And I know that you were saying you were working on your doctorate here at UAS, right? Is that what you were doing?
I did my doctorate up in Fairbanks. And I did a postdoc. Yeah,
right.
Here in Juneau. And then I moved into a research faculty role here at the university.
Yeah, because I feel like UAS is known for sort of its marine biology programs, mostly because of our location, right?
Yeah, we have great marine biology programs. A lot of students in the marine biology degree here at UAS, and obviously we have great access to the natural laboratory of the ocean, just right next door to the university campus. There's also the UAF has a marine biology program here with their CFOS school over in Lena Point, but yeah, UAS has a great marine biology program.
And the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center, the ACRC, is a research group within the University of Alaska Southeast. We do research here in the community and things that are relevant for the community of Juneau. And so there's other faculty besides myself, like Jason Fellman, who does research on salmon streams, biogeochemistry around the state, and we support student interns through the University of Alaska Southeast. We have some staff that do some monitoring programs and some research here. But I'm a assistant professor at the university, but my home is at the ACRC within the university.
Did I read somewhere that you and the team have a grant from NIH, which is the National Institutes of Health? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we have. We just started a grant that is awarded to the Sitka Tribe of Alaska. It's a 5-year grant. I think a little over $7 million to continue monitoring shellfish toxins all through the state, but particularly in Southeast Alaska. So the Sitka Tribe of Alaska has sort of led the charge on monitoring of these shellfish toxins for the last couple years. And they started a research partnership called CTOR, which is the Southeast Alaska Tribal Ocean Research Network. And for the last 5 or 6 years, they've been working with tribes from all across Southeast Alaska and South Central Alaska to gather shellfish and then take phytoplankton samples to monitor their shellfish resources and assess them for toxin levels.
We're talking about paralytic shellfish poisoning, or PSP, not the drug, but the paralytic shellfish poisoning. And that is found in a lot of different clams, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we see it in almost every clam species that we test, and actually it's found outside of clams as well. Pretty much anything that is a filter feeder, you'll see these PSP toxins in, and they can also move through trophic levels. So anything that eats a clam, you might find PSP toxins in those species. So for instance, we see the toxins present in sea otters that are either harvested or stranded here in Southeast Alaska.
Okay, so how do the toxins get created?
Yeah, the toxins are created mostly by a phytoplankton species. The genus is called Alexandrium, and it's a globally distributed genus. It exists at mostly at temperate latitudes, but all around the world. We know that it's been in Southeast Alaska for hundreds of years, and probably longer before that. There's the phytoplankton species. It produces these toxins there's probably a number of reasons why it produces toxins, but the toxin that it produces, the main one, is called saxitoxin. But there's actually at least 50 different chemical congeners, which are all similar to saxitoxin, but structurally a little bit different. They all act in the same way, though, and so we collectively call them paralytic shellfish poisons or paralytic shellfish toxins.
You are way smarter than me.
I don't know about that.
That's a lot of, no, it's really interesting because it's so fascinating and like the detail and the level of information required to process all of that together. And that's why I was asking about like, where does that sort of gut instinct come from to be working on this kind of area? And because I'm sure you're interested in, you know, a lot of things that have to do with marine biology and the things that are in our ecosystem. And I'm just curious, how did it get channeled into this particular field, this particular look at the shellfish poisoning?
One of the things that I'm most interested in doing with respect to this broad field of environmental toxicology is sort of a subset of that research or an area of that research that's called One Health. And this One Health is this idea that human health and wildlife health and environmental health are all linked. You can't really study one without thinking about the other. It's sort of a holistic picture of the health of an area or a region. And when you look at harmful algal blooms, which are these blooms of a species like Alexandrium that produce these toxins, it's a great sort of microcosm for that One Health research because you can look at environmental factors that are directly influencing Alexandrium, like water temperature is a great one. We know with warmer waters, we can expect more Alexandrium and generally producing more toxins. You can also look at wildlife health. I mentioned how we see PSP toxins in sea otter tissues that are harvesting clams that have this PSP toxin in them. And then we can also look at human health. There have been human cases of PSP that have unfortunately resulted in some deaths here in Southeast Alaska. And Southeast Alaska as a whole has the most cases of PSP across the state of Alaska. And so it is an important thing to look at, and it's best done in sort of this holistic context of looking at all of the factors, human and wildlife and environmental factors that lead to these harmful algal blooms.
Okay. So I'm sure that some of this you're going to be talking about in your talk on Friday. We're talking about the fireside chat that is happening this Friday at the Mendenhall Glacier, clams in Southeast, delicious or dangerous. And so you're probably going to be going over some of these issues that you're talking about now. I guess I'm curious about too is when we know that it's dangerous or delicious, I mean, obviously they're delicious, but then we also know that maybe they're a little dangerous. What's the hope for the future? How are we going to, is the research going to help us figure out how to eliminate those toxins from the fish so that the climate and the food source is still available?
We don't really have any great ways of removing the toxin from the clams. That's actually an important thing to note if you've never heard of PSP toxins before or if you're unfamiliar with them. They can't be cooked out or frozen, removed from the clams in those ways. And so if you start, you know, with a raw clam and then you fry it up, it's going to have the same amount of PSP toxins as when it was alive. The thing that we're trying to do with the research and the monitoring that's being done by the tribes here in Southeast Alaska and samples analyzed at the Sitka Tribe of Alaska is we're trying to get a better understanding of when and where these harmful algal blooms are happening, what species are more susceptible to accumulating high concentrations of toxins, and then what sort of seasons and what times of the year will be the safest for consuming and harvesting those clams. And we know that these harmful algal blooms, there is some seasonality to them. We often see them during the summertime, particularly between the months of May and September. There's a very common adage that you can only harvest shellfish in months that have an R. And so that typically excludes the summer months, May, June, July, and August. But what we've found in looking at the data and what people are finding pretty much around the world is that that adage is not a good one to base your harvest off of. We've seen harmful algal blooms and PSP toxins at very high concentrations in April in some communities here in Southeast, and we've also seen really high concentrations of PSP toxins in the fall months, like October and November in some communities. And the fear and what we're hoping to get a better understanding with this grant is as the ocean warms, we might see the window in which we can harvest clams, which is typically during the winter, we might see that window start to shrink from either side. So water might be warmer in the spring, which might lead to earlier blooms, and it might stay warmer later into the fall, which would allow for later fall blooms, including in November and December.
I see. Is there any way for someone who's harvesting the clams to know that the toxin exists?
Yeah, so currently the Sika Tribe of Alaska will accept samples that are harvested for subsistence. And so what they encourage people to do is to collect some clams and then hold them either alive in some seawater, if you know how to do that, or in a freezer, and send a subset of those clams to the Sika Tribe of Alaska Research Lab. They will analyze the toxins, and usually they'll return it to the concentrations to you within a couple of days. And so you can harvest, do a harvest. It's called a harvest and hold practice. And so you can go out, harvest clams. Say you collect, 15 clams. You can take 3 of them or 6 of them, send them to the Sika Tribe, and they will return to you within a couple of days the concentrations of the toxins in those clams.
Wow. Okay. So best advice is don't cook them right away, right?
That is a typically what people recommend is that sort of harvest and hold practice. With the monitoring activities that are going on throughout the rest of the area, there's a lot of communities and tribes within those communities are monitoring the species on a somewhat regular basis. And so you can look online at seator.org, and you can see the data that's posted for each community. And a lot of communities will sample every 2 weeks their shellfish species.
That's great. I was going to ask, where can we get more information? Can you give that website one more time?
Yeah, seator.org.
CTOR.org. Okay, you can find out more information about that.
That's right.
And where can we follow you and your research at?
So the best place would be the ACRC website. We're at acrc.alaska.edu. We have some updates that we push, particularly in the summertime when we're out doing field work and collecting samples. We have some newsletters that come out about ACRC research in general, and that would be a good place to follow me.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, John, for coming, and goodness cheese for being here. John's talk is this Friday. It's part of the Fireside Chats at the Mendenhall Glacier. His talk is called Clams in Southeast, Delicious or Dangerous? Doors open at 6:30 p.m. this Friday, February 21st, and the lecture will start at 7 p.m. if you want to learn more.
Yeah.
I really appreciate you being here. Thanks.
Yeah, gunach shish. Thank you.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Keishi Besikuli, and the word this week is Janwu.
Janwu.
That means mountain goat, and here is a sentence. When boating on the Taku River, people always see mountain goats on the mountains. Let's hear it again. Mountain goat. Gunesh Cheesh to Hune Lance Twitchell, Gould Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Keishi Besikuli is Kokhetan and a child of a Yenyedi man. She is from Daisleen, Teslin, and grew up spending time in Teslin and around Teslin Lake. She earned a master's degree in Indigenous Languages and Linguistics from Simon Fraser University and interviewed many speakers for the Hashagun language series.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm Boston Christopher. And now we continue our journey with the Seabank Chronicles with Logbook 1, Transmission 4, Carbon Sink, a supply box yields natural climate solutions. For more, you can visit thealaskatrust.org/seabankchroniclespodcast.
You've reached the Seabank Chronicles, a natural sound theater transporting you through the living science of Southeast Alaska. Produced by the Alaska Sustainable Fisheries Trust. This is Beth, your radio operator. We live in extraordinary times, where science and mystery meet in a swiftly changing world. To enter the Seabank Chronicles, just keep listening. Logbook 1, Transmission 4, Carbon Sink. Good news, you're receiving a supply shipment today. Pilot bread, chocolate, and the latest research on carbon science. You might have noticed some changes in Seabank weather, record-breaking spikes in air temperature, atmospheric rivers dousing the landscape, interspersed with periods of low rainfall, even drought. The Seabank has always been a patchwork of weather patterns. Skagway has historically received about 26 inches of rain per year, while southern Baranof Island might get over 200. Snow accumulates deeply in Yakutat. On Prince of Wales Island, it rarely lingers. This is due to differences in latitude, topography, and proximity to warm ocean currents or cold mainland air masses. But wider and longer lasting shifts in climate are afoot due to changes in our planet's atmosphere. The latest United Nations report shows that atmospheric carbon dioxide levels reached over 419 parts per million in 2023. That's 50% higher than 200 years ago, before the large-scale burning of coal and gas began on Earth. More carbon dioxide in the atmosphere means more heat trapped at the Earth's surface. But that box coming off the ship has good news, too, besides the chocolate. It has to do with places like the Seabank. Start by reading the article by Beverly Law of Oregon State University. She and colleagues from three other research schools convey what scientists have known for decades. Terrestrial ecosystems remove 30% of carbon emissions from the atmosphere. Certain forests are proven carbon sinks. They store more carbon over long periods than they lose during decay. A net savings of carbon dioxide is stored in their big, old trees. Calculations by environmental scientists like Gavin McNichol at the University of Illinois Chicago reveal that one type of forest tops the list for carbon sinks: cool, wet, temperate rainforests like those found in coastal Alaska. You've probably noticed by now that the Seabank fits this bill. Why are temperate rainforests so good at storing carbon? For one thing, the season for photosynthesis is long thanks to the mild marine climate, so plenty of carbon is taken up during the course of a year. Second, one of the biggest releasers of carbon stores, forest fires, are extremely rare in such environments. In the Seabank, you often need a tarp just to get a campfire going. What separates coastal temperate rainforests from other photosynthetically supercharged environments like tropical rainforests is that they're extremely slow to release the carbon they pull from the atmosphere. In the Seabank, vegetation, especially evergreen trees, take not months or years or decades to break down, but centuries. When they get a hold of carbon, they don't let go. This is especially true about organic matter stored below ground, where microbes labor under damp, oxygen-poor conditions. The title of a 2020 USDA Forest Service article says it all. Forestry as a natural climate solution. Managing forests so they can remove carbon from the atmosphere requires simply that we allow them to continue growing. Unique among your supplies is a personal message. John Schoen, who has studied Southeast Alaska forests since 1977, wants to relay the following. 1. The Tongass contains 20% of carbon sequestered by all national forests in the U.S. combined. 2. The Tongass is arguably the most intact old-growth forest left on our planet. 3. Much of this extraordinary forest continues to stand, which means we still have the opportunity to preserve its carbon sequestering potential. It looks like we're losing signal. We don't have time to cover blue carbon sinks, storehouses of aquatic-based carbon, like the seabank's abundant coastal seagrasses. You'll have to read the report from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in your supply box for details. Find out how you can influence preservation of Southeast Alaska's blue and green carbon sinks in a future transmission of the Seabank Chronicles. Until then, visit thealaskatrust.org/podcast for that NOAA report on blue carbon, a graphic of just how much green carbon Seabank soils store, and an excerpt from an interview with forest scientist John Schoen. Gunish Chish to the Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian people for stewarding these lands and waters since a time beyond human memory, and for sharing them with all who make the Seabank home. When in doubt, keep listening to the places where science and mystery meet.
This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Time now for our first check-in of 2025 with the Juno Police Department. I am joined in the studio now by Deputy Chief Craig Campbell. Thank you so much, Craig. It's good to see you in the new year.
Good afternoon, Boston. Thanks for having me. Good to see you, too.
So it's awesome. There's a lot going on in our world these days and a lot going on with the JPD. But I want to start first with, you know, we always talk about staffing and where you're at with staffing, because I know in the last year or two, you've been on the constant look for new employees and new police officers and dispatchers. And can you give us a little bit of an update on where we're at?
Yeah. You know, the police department, typically in the years past, we always have some vacancies, whether it's in our primary or is going to be with our sworn staff and our dispatchers. So if anybody's out there looking for a job, get on the city website, thejoinjpd.com, and see if any of those careers are the right fit for you. I definitely tell people they could not be disappointed in a career in law enforcement. It's a very satisfying and rewarding career. Thankfully, this past year, we've had seen a big increase in our hiring. We've hired, I want to say it's 8 or 9 new officers. We have several of them currently at the Public Safety Academy. So our hope is, you know, they're going to go after training for about 3.5 months, come back, finish up with our field training program, and then sometime this fall, they'll be out working on their own. So we should see a big increase in our staffing at that point. But we still have a lot of vacancies, and we specifically are looking to target our local community members and to partner with them to becoming police officers, because having community members who know our community, they know what's unique about it, they know what's it needs, and to be able to give back to the community, that's really what we want. And if anybody ever has any questions about, hey, what's it like to be a police officer, I might be of an interest, I always tell them, reach out to me, reach out to the police department. We have a recruiter that can answer any questions they may have. You can do ride-alongs. We really are just looking for people who are, we call them like our locally grown individuals, to be part of our community.
It is a unique situation. We've talked about it on the show a few different times, but the fact that in many other places around the world or in this country, the cop usually live in different cities and then go and work in a city close by. But in Juneau, it doesn't work like that. because we're here and we're sort of landlocked a little bit, or waterlocked, whatever you want to call it. But so you are, the police officers here are really members of the community. We might see you out at dinner. We might see you doing other things that you are doing in a community. And so I love that you're sort of trying to maybe get local folks to be involved. And of course, if you don't want to just be a police officer, like I said, there's dispatcher jobs sometimes, and there's other different things that people can do at the JPD as well.
Yeah, and Juneau is a very diverse community, and so we would look and we look for and would love to have a makeup of that diversity within our police force. And I think that's only reasonable, and that's where we want to help better represent all of our community members.
Is the incentive thing still in play?
Yeah, we still we currently offer a $20,000 signing bonus for new officers. It's $10,000 for dispatchers. Day one, getting a job, you know, we're going to give you that bonus. Well, I think it's half when you first sign up, half when you complete field training. But then you start working. Day one, you're starting to get paid, you know, even before you are fully trained. So that can be a huge benefit to a lot of people.
That's great. I love that it's still in play. And that so if people are out there, and I know some people need some work, so it's, you know, it's a transition.
Yeah. And it's a great job. And it's very rewarding to what you're able to give back to the community.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of cool. All right, let's talk a little bit about some public safety issues. I just noticed that, you know, it's starting to melt a little bit, so it's making me think about, you know, more bikers, more people on their bicycles out and about, maybe more people walking on the side of the road as the sort of snow melts away. And is there things that either riders or drivers need to be thinking about during these times?
Yeah, I think it's just always important to remember that we do have members of our community who are members of that vulnerable population on the roadway, meaning pedestrians, bicyclists, you know, those types of things. If you collide with them in a vehicle, they're going to be severely injured. So it's always important to, try to remove all distractions you have while driving. The biggest culprit of that is going to be cell phones. Eliminate cell phone use while driving.
Boy, that's a big one.
That's a tough one. I know we're all – it's hard to do that, and myself included.
Because I know that you're driving along, you scream at somebody, look at them, they're on their phone. But then you probably also got on your phone, right? So it's like one of those things to remind yourself of, like, be a good driver and try to stay off that phone.
Yeah. And then always driving at a speed that is safe and prudent for the road conditions, you know, whatever those are at the time, whether it's very wet, it's very icy, there's deeper snow, those types of stuff. Even darkness plays in a part in that because you can't see. Stopping at stop signs fully and just giving it a half a second to look around you is a really important one. And I was reminded by that the other day, and you might have seen this before, is that you're driving forward and you're approaching a stop sign and it doesn't look like anybody's coming, and you get there, still doesn't look like, but then you wait that half second and now someone's in your view. Because sometimes a vehicle or a pedestrian can be right in that A-pillar blind spot and it will follow you until you stop, and it just takes that split second to stop and pause, and then they come into view. And I've had that happen multiple times. And it's just a reminder for me, and hopefully for everybody else, is stop those stop signs, give it a second to look. It's important to be safe.
Yeah, there's no rush, that's for sure. All right, so let's talk about a couple of other serious things. I noticed that there was the drug task force that the JPD participates in. I know there was a big one that you just released. I think it was last week. There was a traffic stop, but then the task force was called in because there was a lot of drugs in that particular vehicle, and people had warrants on for them. And is the drug task force? Is it? I guess I'm wondering. Is it really busy? Do we have a real issue?
Yeah, there. I would definitely say we have a good amount of drugs that are coming into our community, and I think a lot of families are feeling the effects of that, whether a loved one or employees that they know or coworkers. We have somebody in our lives who was affected by drug use, and that's pretty sad. But it's out there and it's pretty prevalent. So they are working, they're working quite a bit to try to reduce the inflow of drugs into our community. And thankfully, like that traffic stop, the press release we put out, that was just some great, by chance, some great police work by those officers who initiated the stop, located the drugs, and then they bring in that drug unit who specializes in those types of things to really kind of get into all the details, see if there's other people involved. And I think it was just highlight some great work by both those teams.
Yeah, it's really, you can always go to juno.org/police and you can find the latest press releases. And I'm sure you also talk a little bit about it on your Facebook page. You can follow, I think you're also on X or something like that, and you put out that information. It's just good to know that the task force is working. I know it happens a lot at the airport, things like that, but it's interesting to have just a traffic stop, you know, be able to get that amount of drugs off the street, which is pretty great. Yep. So I know that there have been some shootings recently. We had the one on Christmas Day. There was the one recently in the roundabout. And I know last summer we had the shooting in town. And there's a body camera ordinance that is going to be going to the assembly, I guess, here in March. Can you tell us what you know about that at this point? I know it's still a little figuring out what it's going to be, but it's going to be a good thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think it would just give the police department clear guidance and rules on when the body-worn camera should be released versus, you know, relying just on a policy or maybe outside agencies wanting to be released a specific way in a specific timeline. This would just allow us to say, hey, we release it this time, every time, to the community members. And I think by having those timelines written down, such as in the ordinance, it makes it just clear for everybody. Everybody understands. And that was, I think that was very clear in their shooting from July of last year, is we were missing that from our current policies. Mm-hmm. You know, all of our other shootings that have occurred in the past, we have released the body-worn camera footage in accordance with the review of the Office of Special Prosecutions timelines. But I think the community is looking for that just being written down on in an ordinance or in a policy. And through the ordinance, it just gives us that authority to do that.
Gives you those guidelines, yeah. Because, I mean, I'm sure some people question, you know, why can't it just be released the next day or, you know, 2 days later or within 48 hours? But I'm sure it has to be reviewed, and you have to go through the process in the department, right, to figure out. You need to know what happened before you, because you have to be able to answer questions about it.
Yeah, definitely. You know, like anything, it doesn't just appear, you know, in our evidence system immediately. It has to get uploaded. It has to be reviewed. It has to be certain things have to be redacted because certain things maybe you cannot release to the public, such as maybe identities of witnesses and things like that. And then we have our own policies of, hey, how do we investigate officer-involved shootings? We have to do interviews and things like that just take time. And so we just have to weigh that with the balance of trying to get that information out there as soon as possible for the community.
I understand that. Okay. And in related to these shootings, are there any updates on the recent – I know there was an officer-involved shooting around the holidays, and then there was the recent shooting out in Mendenhall on the roundabout. Can you give us an update on either of those?
Yeah. I know that the investigation of the Christmas Day shooting is currently being reviewed by the Office of Special Prosecutions. So they do a very thorough deep dive review into that, and they provide a publication on that for our department, which we can provide to the community afterwards in conjunction with the body-worn camera release. So that's still in review and progress, and our hope is within the next 2 to 3 weeks, we should be able to get those findings. The one from the roundabout, you know, that one, we had no arrest on the day of the incident. We continued to investigate the case, talk to people who may gather evidence. And ultimately, when that case gets wrapped up, we'll refer it to the prosecuting attorney's agency, the Department of Law, to see if criminal charges are warranted for that.
I see. Okay. And this is just a personal question, but in terms of, like, when you see, you know, a couple people in an argument, or if you see, you know, something going down and you feel like, you know, I feel like sometimes I want to jump in, but then I also sort of stop myself. What's your best advice when, I mean, obviously call 911, but like your best advice for if I see something and I feel like I could intervene, should I, or should I, you know, film it, or should I just call it in, or what should I do?
You know, I think it's, every individual person is going to you know, that decision is theirs to make, right? I can give some general guidance on that. And we always try to advise people is it's always best to be a good witness. So from a safe distance, evaluate what's going on, contact the police department and tell them what's going on. So we have people who can respond and deal with the situation so it's safely. We don't want anybody else to get hurt. And, you know, we need to be notified. So if someone steps in and does their own thing without notifying us, that's going to delay a response. And we might get there and might not have, you know, information as far as what happened. So safety is probably the biggest key for everybody. And then just notifying the police department in a timely manner.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And then the last question, there were rumors recently, and I know you guys put out a statement about this, but in terms of that ICE was in Juneau, perhaps rounding people up, and some of those rumors turned out to not be true. But what's the JPD's position on that particular, you know, ICE in Juneau situation?
Yeah, as far as the police department is concerned, we never received any reports from any community members that I'm aware of, especially at that time, we didn't get any of anything like that happening. And where that's important is if things are happening, and we put out in our press release, like, if that happened, you please let us know, because we want to be able to track that down and go, okay, what really happened? So if ICE was in town and they were contacting people, what was it really about? But we never received any reports from community members about that. And as far as we're, as far as the information that we've received, it doesn't appear like anything like that occurred. And ICE was not in town doing any activity like that.
Is ICE required to contact Juneau Police Department?
No, they're not. They typically, along with any other federal agencies who aren't like stationed in Juneau, if they come to town, they typically let their local law enforcement know to, in case, you know, they call for assistance, we get a report of them doing something. And some of it is just a courtesy, but then it is also a safety issue. If, you know, a federal agency is a town acting in some type of law enforcement capacity and something happens, we may respond and just not know that they're there. And that can create confusion and a lot of dysfunction. So for the most part, all federal agencies will come to town and let us know and give us a heads up that we may be working in there.
Absolutely. Deputy Chief Craig Campbell, thanks so much for answering our questions and visiting with us this month, and hopefully we'll see you next month.
Thank you. Take care.
Appreciate it. Gunath Cheesh. And you can find out more and follow everything with the Juneau Police Department at juneau.org/police. Up next, the Juneau Nordic Ski Club is here with info on their upcoming Communiski event happening on Sunday, March 2nd, working to raise $1 for every Juneauite in support of every kid getting the opportunity to ski. But first, a rich tradition with Angela Davis.
A little more than 40 years ago, I was teaching at UCLA. Because I was fired from my position in the philosophy department there, my whole story began. So you might say that it's a trajectory, you know, from one campus to another campus with a lot of, you know, very interesting, dangerous, exciting encounters in between.
I'm Jim Luce. Today, political activist, scholar, and educator, Angela Davis speaks about her life.
I was speaking somewhere and someone introduced me as the third woman in history to have been placed on the FBI's most wanted list, and everybody in the audience applauded. Well, I mean, that's interesting because I had forgotten. I had actually repressed that fact.
During the 1960s, she was known worldwide as an activist for social change.
It was also very scary. I became involved in a whole number of campaigns. The Soledad Brothers was one of the campaigns in which I got involved. And it was as a result of my activity, I found myself charged with what were at that time three capital crimes, murder, kidnapping, and conspiracy. I always like to point out that it was not so much what I did that has led to my being widely known. All of that could have happened to me in obscurity, but it was because of vast campaign, people all over the country, and then people all over the world, in Europe, in Africa, in Asia. I just returned from India. Almost everywhere I've gone in the world, people have told me that there were people involved at that time. And that is why I think, regardless of the fact that I was innocent, I could have been innocent and sentenced to death. It was because of that campaign that I was eventually freed.
A Rich Tradition was produced by Jim Luce in association with WCSU in Wilberforce, Ohio.
AAPRC, the African American Public Radio Consortium.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clan Edi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. You are listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Sunday, March 2nd, Communiski from the Juno Nordic Ski Club is looking for the community to ski more than 2,500 kilometers to raise money to give every kid in Juno a chance to ski. And I am joined in the studio now by Tristan Knutson-Lombardo, who is the coach or one of the coaches.
One of the coaches, yeah.
One of the coaches. And then we also have from the middle school ski team, we have Genevieve Coleman. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you both in the studio. Wasa Iti, how's it going?
Goodness cheese, thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about this cool idea. Like, I was reading through this, and I was like, this is really cool. So Tristan, tell us a little bit about what Communiski is all about.
Our Communiski, that's a great question. Communiski started, this is our eighth year, I think, doing it. It actually started even before that as a way for the Juno Nordic Ski team to celebrate. For those that know Keegan Randall, she kind of, you know, Alaska-born, Alaska-raised ski prodigy she was. And she was the part of the first pair of skiers to win a gold medal for the U.S. at the Olympics several iterations ago. And so there was a celebration on the Menhall Lake to just randomly bring the community together, see how far we can ski, maybe raise a little money on the side. And it's kind of grown over the years to be this big fundraiser. It's our biggest fundraiser that the ski club puts on to support youth Nordic skiing here in Juneau. So we both invite people to come and spend the day skiing. How far can we collectively ski as a community? Hence the Communiski. And then, in case I had to spell that out.
Right,
and then,
right.
And then we raise money. And our goal is to raise $1 for every Juneau resident. So, which is, you know, that goal could get easier over the years if our population continues to decline, but hopefully it gets harder because we're going to, our population will eventually grow again.
We want it to grow. and right now you have it listed as, where did you get the number for? Because right now in your notes it was $31,377.
Mark Wheeler looked it up online.
We got to trust Mark, of course. If Mark looked it up, it's probably right. Okay. But that's kind of fun to see, like, because I know it's probably there's more people in Juneau right now just because of the legislature maybe. But in terms of residents,
We didn't factor that in.
Yeah, I mean.
Typically, we've raised between $26,000 and $30,000. It's usually landed somewhere in there. So
that's
we figured,
so cool.
let's give the dollar amount some meaning.
And before we talk to Genevieve, just give me a little bit of the theory behind that every kid deserves a chance to ski. What does that mean to the Juno Nordic Ski Club?
That's a great question. We were I was working with Dirk Miller the last couple weeks to get some school groups out on skis. And he was saying, you know, we live in almost an Arctic climate town, but we have snow and we have, you know, sort of reliable snow depending on where you want to find it.
And not today.
Not today. Actually, I just got done skiing. I found the snow.
You found some?
But doesn't every kid deserve the opportunity to experience skiing? It can be a high barrier activity or sport depending on your family's resources or can you get to the trailhead? Do you have the right gear? or could we just take away all those barriers and say, let's go to where kids are and let's give them a chance to see if skiing is something that they might want to, you know, pursue further in their life.
So is it something that the ski club helps to provide equipment and things? Because there are, it seems like there are barriers to entry because some of that stuff can get quite expensive.
Absolutely. We currently we have an elementary program and then a middle and a high school team. And one of the things we do is we offer low to no cost equipment rentals, because we know that's one of the big barriers is finding the right stuff. And we also want to make sure people have good skis. You know, it's hard enough, as Genevieve can attest, to propel yourself down the snow sometimes. So why give yourself bad gear? Why not give yourself good gear to make it a little bit easier? So we want to make sure that that whatever those barriers are, we can just get rid of those and say, just come try the sport. And if you like it, we'll keep at it. We'll work with you. And we also are working. We've been piloting an in-school ski program this year and next year. Our goal is to grow and expand that. So these dollars that we raise support all of those things.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you can probably find out all information on registering and finding out how to join the ski club at jnski.org. Simple website. I love it. jnski.org. You can go there and you can learn all about this fundraiser as well as how to get your kids involved in the program.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. All right, Genevieve. Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. So when did you start skiing?
I started skiing like 2 years ago, I think.
Okay. And how did you decide to start skiing?
My mom, she cross-country skis. She's skied for like a while. And she suggested that I ski with her. So.
I see. So mom wanted a little daughter time and made it happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what is your favorite part about the skiing?
I like skiing with all of my friends. Like it's not boring.
It's not boring. Okay. And when do you, is it an after school thing that you all do?
Yeah.
Okay. And you're on the middle school ski team. So what does that involve?
Like we just like kind of just go out and like ski. Sometimes we have like races. Last week, I think we had a race with the high schoolers, and that was like really fun. So,
did you beat them?
No.
What's the hardest part about skiing?
Convincing myself that it's not going to be cold.
Oh, interesting. You want to be inside. You have a cat shirt on, I noticed. Or is that way? That's a hamster.
Hamster. Hamster shirt.
It looked like cats. But I was like, you're one of those folks who likes to be inside under a blanket most of the time, probably.
Yeah, if I'm cold, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have to get the gear on. Is it, because it seems like it's a ramp up, right? You got to get the gear on. You got to get the skis on. And is it, are you also doing downhill skiing or is it mostly cross country?
It's pretty much all cross country.
All cross country. Okay. And what are your trail? Are there different trails, like ones that you prefer? Or do you just go and on like the side of the road near your house or something?
We go to like a few different places. We go to Montana Creek and Eagle Crest. But I think my favorite place is the lake.
The lake.
It's so flat.
Okay, awesome. Now, when you get to these, the middle school ski club, is it competitive or is it, I know you said you were against the high school team. Are you guys doing things against each other? Are you working against other groups, other teams? How does it work?
It's like we like are all kind of skiing together like most of the time, but every once in a while we'll like have a race and then it's kind of like against each other.
I see. But you're really trying to like get your personal best, right? You're trying to beat your personal best time?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And what are the distances that you are working with?
I don't really know how far it is, but we usually, like, when we go to Eagle Crest, which was the last race with the high schoolers, we usually do, like, a few laps around, like, the meadow.
Okay. And do we know how far, what's that distance around the meadow? Do we know?
The race that you all did last week in the skiathlon, which is actually a cool race.
Yeah.
It's the first leg is skate skiing. For those that...
What is skate skiing?
Yeah, for those that don't know, it's if you can imagine ice skating on a lake, it's like that except for you've got skis, so you're doing that motion on skis. And then the second leg was classic skiing, which is sometimes more the traditional what people think of.
With the poles with and the, yeah.
Yeah, we use poles with skate skiing too, but where you're kind of, I'm going to say walking, but it's not really walking. But
it's like speed walking.
It's like, yeah, but it's that same motion with your arms and your legs.
Yeah. Okay.
And they were each 1.5 kilometers, the lap. So it's 3 kilometers total for the middle school
Okay,
team.
So this is for either of you, but how are we going to accomplish 2,500 kilometers? How do we do that? Are we going to one location and going around a circle a lot of times? Or are we doing like trails and keeping track? How does that work?
Do you remember how far you skied last time?
Last year? No, I don't.
No. I think you were like 30 or 25 kilometers, somewhere in there. That's a good question. We're gonna pick a spot, and you know, because it's Juno, and you know the snow. Who knows what the snow is gonna be like in a week and a half? We're gonna wait a little bit to say, okay, this is our spot. We've been on the Menhall Lake before. We've been at the camp. Last year was in the campground because we didn't have the Menhall Lake. We've been up at the Eagle Crest on the lower Nordic trails there. Mm-hmm. So we'll wait and see what the weather gives us, and then we just spend all day. Skiing. There's a big aid station with music and lots of food and warm drinks or cold drinks, whatever you need. There's a big board. We'll do check marks for the kilometers we ski. Our sport operates in kilometers, which can be confusing for some people when they're used to miles. But
and what is the conversion? Should we ask Genevieve?
Do you know?
I have no idea.
Okay, write it down, everybody. Write it down. 1.6 kilometers per mile.
Is 1 mile, okay.
Roughly.
Okay. Okay, that's good to know. 1.6.
And it's like 1.609 if you wanted to.
Right, okay. So, yeah, so we're trying to go like, I don't know, 1,900 miles or something or whatever it would be. That's crazy. That's awesome, though. Yeah. That's going to be a lot of fun. So you have – how many people will participate in the Communiski?
We'll have all of the skiers in our youth programs, which we have about 110 between the three programs. We'll be there throughout the day. And then we have a lot of community members come in. Last year there's probably about 100 different adults that kind of filter in and out. You can come for the whole day, for part of the day. You just show up and start doing your tallying. You can donate there at the event. You can donate online beforehand. You can donate after. We'll take your money whenever, however.
Whichever way is possible. Okay, so let's get a – we don't know the location yet. So where do we keep an eye out for that information? On the website or on your Facebook page or where?
JNski.org, and we'll also put it on Facebook and Instagram. So if you're clued into one of those three things, you'll get a you'll find out where it is.
Okay, great. And then what time will it start?
The high schoolers will start skiing at 10. The middle school team, you all are going to start at 11. And then our elementary program joins us at lunchtime, and we do kind of a big photo, and then people keep skiing. And so you can join at any point in that time.
That's awesome. Well, Genevieve's going to check the temperature first.
That's
before,
right.
Before, because if it's warmer at noon, she might be a little late.
Yeah.
I get that. It's Sunday, March 2nd. It is the Communiski. It's part of the Juno Nordic Ski Club. It involves all of their different clubs, right? The elementary, the middle school, the high school. And then the community is welcome, right? Anybody
Absolutely.
Can show up and help contribute towards this 2,500 miles. You can also show up and watch and be a participant. Do you need volunteers and such too?
Sure, especially if people want to come. We have like the mothership, we call it, the main aid station. And if you've got a good playlist or a good brownie recipe you want to cook up and bring.
Right.
Please, yeah.
That's good. It's their biggest fundraiser. They're trying to raise $1 for every resident of Juneau. According to Mark Wheeler, that's $31,377.
We're holding you to it, Mark.
And, I think we got it. Is that everything? Is that all of it?
Yeah.
I think that's good.
We look forward to seeing everyone out there. Thanks, Boston.
Yeah, of course. Go to jnski.org for the Communiski from the Juneau Nordic Ski Club. Genevieve, Tristan, thanks so much, for being here.
Thank you.
That will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, our Rainy Day Conversation series continues with Alaska's new writer laureate, 3-time Emmy-nominated Vera Starbar. Vera's plays have been produced at Perseverance, and she has been a writer on Molly of Denali and Alaska Daily. That's Juno Afternoon's Rainy Day Conversations with Vera Starbart tomorrow. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Support for the program comes from Heritage Coffee and Hanson Gress. I'm Boston Christopher. Gwyneth Cheesh!